If you ask somebody if they're pro-life or pro-choice, they're going to give you one or the other. But if you ask, do you believe that women and families should make decisions about their whole entire lives, including abortion, for themselves alongside their families, they'll say yes. Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. And this week, actually, from a particular WOC perspective.
Ooh.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, and you have me intrigued.
Well, yeah, you know, WOC, Women of Color, because joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Tania Esparza. She's Executive Director of Young Women United. Hey, Tania.
Hi, buenos dias.
Buenos dias. And in our Harlem studio, we have Regina Mahone. She's Vice President and Managing Editor of Rewire.News. What's up, Regina?
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we're going to talk about reproductive rights, really for women of color. And at the end of June, well, there was this bombshell that happened. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, often the key swing vote for reproductive rights, basically shocked the entire world by saying that he's retiring at the end of July. And actually, like, what is the backstory of why Justice Kennedy decided to step down right now? But what we do know is that during Trump's campaign, he promised to nominate a conservative justice who would, in fact, overturn the landmark abortion rights decision, Roe v. Wade,
which includes, in fact, states a woman's right to abortion.
Well, if that would happen, because I am pro-life and I will be appointing pro-life judges, I would think that that will go back to the individual states.
So right now, this is the perfect opportunity for that. And Trump announced his pick on Monday night. It's Judge Brett M. Kavanaugh.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person.
Now, Judge Kavanaugh is part of the legal conservative establishment. He also served in President George W. Bush's administration. He's shown hints at being an abortion rights opponent. For example, he authored an opinion against an undocumented minor's right to an abortion. So abortion in this country, it's actually a relatively common experience for women. There have been declines that are a result of course, better contraceptive use. According to the Guttmacher Institute, one in four women in the United States will have an abortion by the age of 45, one in four. And still, reproductive rights, well, they've actually always been at risk in this country. Guttmacher also reported that just in the first 4 months of this year, five states have adopted 10 new abortion restrictions, and 37 states introduced over 300 measures to restrict access to either abortion or to contraception. So that fight is probably going to gain some new strength with what's happening on the Supreme Court. Now, Regina, what do you think we can expect in terms of Kennedy's replacement, given that Republicans have the majority in the Senate? And do you think that overturning Roe v. Wade is actually going to happen?
We're looking at four states that already have trigger laws in place that would immediately recriminalize abortion. That's Louisiana, Mississippi, South Dakota, North Dakota. And then a number of other states are already have bans on the books that would become enforceable once Roe is overturned, and then other states that have promised to.
Dude, okay, you're scaring me. Like you're saying, like within, just give me the timeline. You're like, because you're just like in four states, it's going to happen immediately. Like what exactly?
Sure. You know, according to our legal analyst Jessica Mason Piccolo, it's very likely that there will be cases brought to the Supreme Court that they'll be deciding on that would effectively unwind the fundamental right to abortion. And once that happens and Roe is no longer in place, then it looks like there, as I mentioned, there are four states with these trigger laws and then a number of other states that are looking at banning abortion outright.
Wow. I mean, I had to step back for a second, Regina, because what you said, I needed a minute to absorb it, as they say.
I know, because when you actually hear people talking about the fact,
seriously,
and it's coming out of their mouths and they're saying abortion will be illegal in these states, in the United States of America, it's like you just have to take a pause and say it's the year 2018. So, Tanya, are you in agreement with this super fast timeline?
I think what I wanted to offer is just that, you know, the erosion and chipping away of abortion access has been happening long before the Trump era. We've been feeling the effects of this state by state, little by little, legislative session after legislative session. And, you know, these national decisions are now beginning to, I think, take on more visibility, and more of our people are feeling it. So, you know, our most vulnerable communities, our women of color communities, our LGBTQ communities, our immigrant families have been feeling the brunt of these acts against abortion mm-hmm. access for a long time. And I think now that it's becoming more visible, more of us are starting to pay attention.
And, you know, it seems like yesterday we were having all of these protests with women with pink hats all around the country and the world. And now it seems like we're having a debate in Congress to choose a justice that could change the way reproductive health is provided in this country. So do you think that the energy can be picked up again to pressure our leaders, U.S. leaders, to promote reproductive rights in this particular time?
The system is stacked against Democrats. When the Republican leadership decided to hold off on allowing Obama's pick for the Supreme Court justice to have a hearing, there was a lot of assumptions being made that Hillary Clinton would be the next president, so we wouldn't end up in the situation that we're in. So it seems like Democrats are really trying to figure out their next steps.
It is a little disconcerting, though I suppose not surprising, that the Democrats actually don't have kind of like an immediate plan of action.
It is.
It's almost defeatist.
But it does seem like advocates are doing as much as they can to try to build off the momentum of the Holmes v. Hellerstedt case. The Supreme Court decided in 2016 to ban two trap laws in the state of Texas, an admitting privileges law measure and a ambulatory surgical centers measure. And they recently launched a new lawsuit that's making its way through the courts. And so if the Democratic leadership isn't up to the task, it seems like advocates across the country aren't going to let them just throw in the towel.
And what about you, Tanya?
I mean, I think that, you know, as a state-based group, the work has been happening in the states for such a long time through this administration and through our previous one, even when even thinking about moving something proactive was still largely symbolic, that here in the states, we have so much to work with. And like Regina said, I think that our advocate communities are really, really working hard to hold the line for our individual states. And I think it's a time where we really have to look at what place-based organizing, place-based strategies look like, because I think that's going to be the remaining hope for many of us.
Even with Justice Kennedy, there's already been a wave of Supreme Court decisions that have limited reproductive rights. And at the end of June, there was a 5-4 decision on the California case, which was the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates v. Becerra, that basically said crisis pregnancy centers can give the reproductive health care information they want, even if it's incorrect, because of their First Amendment rights or freedom of speech protections. The case, I think, looks at the 2015 Reproductive Fact Act out of California. That was a response to the very same pregnancy centers that were giving false and misleading information to patients.
Right. And so Rewire.news reported on this ruling saying, quote, "The Reproductive Fact Act disclosures are extremely straightforward. Facilities that are licensed as pregnancy centers by the state must display a brief statement disclosing that California offers access to free and low-cost birth control and abortion care, along with a number to call for more information. Unlicensed centers must disclose, in up to 13 languages, that they are not medical facilities and that they do not offer medical care." But the Supreme Court carved out a special disclosure law for crisis pregnancy centers, and the disclosure rule is this: they don't have to disclose jack shit. That's from Rewired.News.
All right. Not Maria Noosa.
Yeah, not me. All right. So let me just wind back for a second, because I actually covered this story at CNN. So let me just paint a picture for you. In the Bronx, you would get out of the subway and you would walk out and you would see a huge banner saying unwanted pregnancy, question mark. And across the street in an unmarked building, actually, were the offices of Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood was unmarked because they don't want to draw attention to themselves. So you get out and you're a woman who's in the middle of, you know, planning to get an abortion. And you see in a huge banner unwanted pregnancy and you're like, oh, that's where I'm going. You would walk up the stairs thinking that you're going to Planned Parenthood. You would sit down and then immediately they would start showing you videos. They had photographs. They would offer you. And meanwhile, Planned Parenthood was across the street waiting for you to have your appointment for your abortion legally provided. And this is what's basically being allowed, this kind of misrepresentation. So, Regina, you're like, uh-huh.
Well, you know, a reasonable person would say the outcome of this case raises a lot of questions and concerns. When you're a patient, ideology goes out of the window. You're not thinking about whether or not you're pro-choice or anti-choice. You're thinking about the fact that you need basic information, and you're being deprived of that information by these clinics. We call them fake clinics. They're not crisis pregnancy centers. They're masquerading as healthcare facilities, and investigations have shown they outright lie to patients about, you know, they'll tell them things like abortion causes breast cancer and
that it's emotionally traumatizing forever and that you're going to be scarred and that there's like scientific proof of this, of which there is not.
No, not at all.
You know what? The scary thing about this, too, you know, we're here in New Mexico as a rural state where we have a shortage of providers in general. It's really scary to think that crisis pregnancy centers are actually located in some of our communities where we don't have any access to healthcare, any access to a Planned Parenthood or any sort of a clinic. And so they locate themselves in a place that establishes their power. So our communities are coming in trying to find, you know, some semblance of access to healthcare, and they're finding themselves being lied to. And those communities, of course, continue to be people who have the least access to begin with, which is, it's so, so scary.
Right. And Tanya, Albuquerque voters, they defeated a harmful anti-abortion ballot, right, by a 10-point margin. And you actually wrote in Rewired.News, you said, as a queer Chicana and daughter of immigrant parents from Mexico, the joy in my heart at the sight of families like mine who showed up and drove to defend our bodies, our lives, and our decisions were unmatched by anything else I'd ever felt. But how is the battle overall happening in New Mexico, and why are you hopeful about the future?
I mean, absolutely. I think, New Mexico has some of the best reproductive health policies in the country. And while we have been seeing the chipping away of abortion access in other places, we've actually felt it because we remain as one of the havens, one of the only places where people are able to access abortion care. So we have many people traveling miles and miles and miles to come get their care here. And I think what's so important about what we've built here in New Mexico is that the strategies that have been led by women of color, by queer people of color, are the strategies that are working. We've thrown away the call-out culture of our movement and really, really grounded ourselves in the values that many of us have been raised with. Values of respect, values of like, of you don't throw anybody away. One, because we can't afford it, but also because we care about each other. And I think that that is what has saved New Mexico's policies on reproductive health across the board. We don't start a conversation about abortion without having a conversation about a full range of pregnancy-related care, from access to breastfeeding to prenatal care. That really, really, really paints a picture of this issue can't be talked about in isolation anymore. Mm-hmm. Because then it becomes, you know, the conversation no one wants to have, when in fact it's part of pregnancy-related care conversations our grandmas, our tías, our primas have been having forever.
Hey, we're back, and this is In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and with me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. This week, we're joined by Tania Esparza and Regina Mahone. We're talking reproductive rights and women of color. Let's jump back to the conversation. So I have a personal relationship to this issue because I ended up writing a motherhood memoir about having two miscarriages before I was able to give birth to my two children. I've also been married to my husband for coming up on, 28 years together. But when I was in college, and I had to write about this because I was telling my story. I had two abortions and I was using contraception. So I know that once I was public about this, my own family, very traditional, mom and dad, Mexican, they had a really, you know, they were there for me. But I think that, you know, we make an assumption about certain people and their positions. And actually, it's a very intimate, personal, medical issue. And I'm glad that we can talk about it. And I think I made a big miscalculation with Latino, Latina voters last time around. I think I did not realize how many of them actually were specifically moved because they are, quote unquote, pro-life or anti-abortion.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, a lot more Latinos and Latinas were voting for Trump on this particular issue than I even realized. So,
right.
So Tania, what are the particularities in terms of how the Latinx community is perhaps being overlooked? Our complexity vis-a-vis reproductive rights is somehow being overlooked.
I think for a long time, reproductive rights have been framed from a very polarizing ideological perspective. You're either pro-life or pro-choice. But the reality is that many of our families don't find themselves in either box. And we have to be able to create that gray area because it exists. You know, we've learned from that Respect Albuquerque Women campaign we ran 6 years ago that it matters how you approach the conversation. It matters how you ask the question. If you ask somebody if they're pro-life or pro-choice, they're going to give you one or the other. But if you ask people, do you believe that women and families should make decisions about their whole entire lives, including abortion, for themselves alongside their families, they'll say yes. So I think it's critical for us to reclaim the framing of this conversation and get in front of the narrative that puts our families in this conservative box that doesn't fit.
We've covered this at Futuro Media. I just need to talk about America by the numbers. When you went out to Rochester, Maria, Black mothers are more likely to die in childbirth.
Right. So one of the stories that we covered on our public television series, America by the Numbers, was this story of toxic stress in African-American communities, Black women, Latina women, and how living in conditions of perpetual stress over decades, potentially centuries, actually has an impact on your reproductive health. And so some of these babies are dying to Black women and Latina women, impacted, in fact, in part because of toxic stress. You know, and toxic stress is kind of like stress that never goes away. You know, hunger, living in a violent community, you know, being a former slave who was, you know, being hunted down, and how that kind of gets embedded in your system. It's that kind of stress.
So, Regina, you've written about reimagining Black motherhood, right? In Rewired, mm-hmm. in Rewired.news, you wrote, and I'm quoting, "Since chattel slavery on stolen land, state actors have sought to control Black women's reproduction and ability to parent in one way or another."
Hmm.
So tell us about those challenges specifically to Black motherhood and maternal health for women of color.
And I guess in the context, Regina, of, you know, what we're all witnessing, which is children of color being torn away.
That too.
Ripped away from their mother's arms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to include as part of this conversation the reproductive justice framework and the significance of saying that Black women not only have the right to parent and choose not to parent, but to parent in safe and healthy environments. And that framework is applied to communities of color broadly. And so the conversation around police violence and the way that Black mothers' children are being stolen by the police, and then what we're seeing along the border and the way that ICE agents are separating families. I mean, this is all connected. all of these oppressions are connected. But when you talk about the Black maternal health crisis, you know, you mentioned Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die while giving birth than white women. There's been a lot of coverage of this issue, thankfully. It's been lifted up. A number of organizations have been doing this work for a very long time. Recently, the Black Mamas Matter Alliance has helped to lift up and amplify these stories. They've been covered in the New York Times and other places, highlighting this importance of doulas, talking about the birth justice movement, that a lot of people are empowering themselves and safeguarding pregnancy when Black women were never really given that right.
Oh, don't even get me started. Because in Rochester, New York, the place that we've been talking about, where we did our America by the Numbers documentary, so infant mortality is double the national average there. And in this county, Monroe County, infant mortality rates among Black people are 3 times higher than among white people, according to the county's data in 2015. And for Latinos, it's more than double the infant mortality rates for whites. And this is in Rochester, New York. So, Tanya, what do we know in terms of what you're seeing, let's say, for example, in the Southwest, on issues of infant mortality or maternal mortality, women dying in the process of giving birth?
I mean, sadly, you know, what Regina was talking about, I think here in New Mexico applies mostly to, as a majority people of color state, it applies mostly to Native indigenous communities that, again, like, we don't have access to basic health care. And to paint this picture a little bit more clear, one of our major hospitals in the northern part of the state closed down their entire maternity ward. So that means that people have to drive 3 hours away from home to be able to get like basic prenatal care, not even just like the delivery of their children.
Wow.
But they have to drive 3 hours. And so as a rural state, it's been so important for us at Young Women United to work on making sure that people have access to a full range of birthing options. So what Regina was talking about in terms of birth justice, this for us has meant that we're working to reclaim midwifery models of care. And we've been working really closely with local midwives that carry indigenous, Native, and Chicano Latino knowledge into the birthing process, into supporting women in their homes. And we really do believe, and we know that when midwives are part of the continuum of care, our community's outcomes are much, much better. It means that they can travel to their homes instead of them having to travel 3 hours away. Our midwives travel to their homes and support them, you know, alongside their pregnancies.
And Regina, you mentioned the connection between reproductive rights and our country's criminal justice system and immigration detention regime. There's actually a term. It's called Jane Crow, basically saying how racial, sexual, and gender oppression directly impacts Black women. But we also know that there's a history of sterilization, not only with Black women, but women of color. And I'd be remiss to not bring up Puerto Rico in the 40s and the 50s when that was happening, when the U.S. government was sterilizing Puerto Rican women.
Dude, and you know, in California up until the 1970s, I mean, for decades, California led the number of sterilizations done on both men and women, oftentimes without their consent. And we also have the history, not that long ago, like in the 1980s, of the forced sterilization of Native Americans in this country.
Right. And also like restriction of abortion rights of inmates and detained immigrants. There's even immigrant activists being detained, like reproductive justice activist Alejandra Pablos, who was featured on Latino USA recently. So, Regina, how do these restrictions of reproductive rights and sexual health impact women of color and immigrant women that are behind bars?
So to start with immigration and the intersections of immigration and age and reproductive rights, our reporter Tina Vasquez has done incredible reporting around the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which has come under fire over the past 8 months, preventing young minors in their custody, specifically Scott Lloyd, the director of ORR, preventing young minors from accessing abortion, saying he had to personally sign off on any action that facilitates an abortion. And so there's these young women who are effectively being held hostage in the shelters where we've placed them as a country, and not allowing them to exercise their right to abortion, their fundamental reproductive rights.
The thing is that some of those women, they might need abortions because, in fact, they were raped as they were traveling north.
Right.
On their way. Yeah,
on their way here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And now there are reports of women, immigrant women who are being held in detention, that they are miscarrying, that they're being denied kind of basic care for pregnant women, that some of them are being shackled. And this is apparently a new policy that the Trump administration quietly put in, which is that you can hold a pregnant woman, immigrant, as long as she's not in her third trimester. Apparently, under the Obama administration, unless it was an extreme circumstance, women who were pregnant were not supposed to be detained and held.
But then there's, you know, when you're talking about citizens, non-immigrants in the criminal justice system, that intersects with reproductive rights in a couple of ways. I think when you're talking about abortions, there's, you know, people who are incarcerated have to pay for cover the cost of their any service or procedure they're looking for when it comes to reproductive health. They also have to cover the cost of transportation and security to get to the facility. And for you're talking about people who are incarcerated, they often don't have the money to cover that. And so then they may be forced, you know, by the state to carry those pregnancies to term. Once they've carried those pregnancies and are giving birth, there's the issue around restraints and being shackled during pregnancy.
Wow.
And then you're also talking about sterilization for the people who maybe are then being sterilized and incarcerated. I mean, this issue covers the spectrum of reproductive rights, health and justice.
Tanya.
You know, alongside the conversation around forced sterilization here in New Mexico, we've seen it through the Indian Health Service for our Native communities. And recently, there's been efforts to implement long-acting reversible contraception, which is basically an IUD. It's like the new thing to prevent, quote-unquote, teen pregnancy. And we, as an organization that works alongside young people and really believes that at any age, people should be able to make decisions about their own bodies for themselves— we've been really, really trying to combat and remind our Department of Health, remind our really well-intentioned providers of the ethics around consent, and to remind us that it's so, so important to be able to carry these conversations very carefully and not replicate sort of the coercion and the forced sterilization remnants are still alive and we still feel today here in New Mexico and in many places. So I think that when we're having these conversations about how to not make the same mistakes that have been made in the past, that this is still a relevant conversation to the criminalization conversation, to the full range of reproductive health access that our families still need.
All right, so what we're going to do for our last segment is we're going to do something that we call temperature check. And we'll start with you, Tanya. How are you personally feeling about the state of reproductive rights in the United States?
Every day looking at the news is so absolutely triggering sometimes. Sometimes I can't afford to look at the news because it's devastating to see what is happening across the board. And then I have to remind myself that the work that many of us have been doing, that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, of reproductive justice leaders who've been doing this work in worse conditions. And I have to remind myself that there are beautiful things that are happening as well. So while I may feel defeated some days, I feel like I stay grounded on the fact that our movements are really sprouting moments of joy in the midst of such chaos. That brings me some life and encourages me to nurture the joy in my life with my family, with the little ones in my life, to be able to stand and continue for another day because, God, this shit is hard.
I was going to say, because this shit is hard.
This shit is hard.
Uh-huh. Regina.
It's devastating. Seeing these stories come in, day out, working with folks who are sharing their stories and how, you know, comparing stories that were told before Roe and after Roe and how, you know, in some situations it seems like little has changed. But also feeling really inspired in this moment as a journalist, which I think is a radical thing to say, considering the environment journalists are in right now. But frankly, we have more tools at our disposal than we've ever had before. We have our work cut out for us, but I'm really looking forward to, you know, continuing to cover what is going on in these communities and making sure that we're amplifying as many stories as we can, because that's at the end of the day what we're here to do, just tell these stories.
Because, okay, hold on a second. Before we end, I actually have to ask a question. So, Danya and Regina, for the entirety of your lives, abortion has been legal. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
All right. So I'm revealing, right, my age. I was born at a time when abortion was not legal in the United States, which is why I'm like, okay, there's a generation of women who have lived with abortion as essentially the law of the land.
True.
And, you know, for me, this was a very, I was a kid growing up in the political movement, the women's movement, and reproductive rights and abortion rights were central to this.
Yeah.
I have this memory of this one particular photo. I'm desperately searching for it. I thought it was in Time magazine, a woman in a fetal position in a pool of blood. But what we do know, and it may have been this same photograph, this photograph was in Ms. magazine. It created a huge stir. The woman was Jerry Santoro. She was hunched over in a pool of blood in a Connecticut hotel. It was a back alley abortion. It was published 9 years after her death, less than a year after the passing of Roe v. Wade. And the headline for Ms. Magazine was Never Again. And the NARAL, Pro-Choice America Foundation, reported that before Roe v. Wade, an estimated 1.2 million women in the United States had illegal abortions every single year, and that as many as 5,000 women died in the United States every year because of having a bad abortion. So the thought that, as you know, that there may be young women who end up seeing in their lives the fact that this could become illegal.
Wow.
And, you know, women have been needing and getting abortion since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. And desperate women will resort to desperate situations. We know this. Many of us have been there. Desperation leads to desperation.
I mean, we are at a time where things like medication abortion, you know, are accessible in a way that it wasn't before Roe. And so there is a lot of conversations around how to make it more accessible to people should Roe be overturned, because the majority of abortions are occurring at a time when people could take a medication abortion pill and terminate. So it may be a different time, but it'll be a time.
It's definitely a different time. Thank you so much, Regina Mahone, Vice President and Managing Editor of Rewire.News, and to Tania Esparza, Executive Director of Young Women United in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this edition of In the Thick.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much for having me on the show.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Regalo Varela.
And we have a little bit of tarea. That would be homework.
Homework.
See, you're even getting a Spanish lesson when you listen to In the Thick. Please go to inthethick.org/survey, because we really want to hear from you. We love getting feedback, and like, we want to get to know you. And if you do the short survey, you'll be entered into a raffle for some possible futuro swag.
Swag.
Yeah. Yeah, we got some. Also, remember to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. This really helps. Also, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your family and friends to listen. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnum, Stephanie LeBeau, and Nicole Rothwell. Our intern is Sheila Colon. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We will see you on the next edition of In the Thick. Thank you so much for listening. Ahí nos vemos.
Ciao. Energy, energy, energy.
High energy, energy. Super high energy. Yeah, super high energy.
I got the power.
There you go. There you go.